2. From Hero to Celebrity, the Human Pseudo-Event. He's the greatest. Anonymous, becoming unanimous. In the last half century, we have misled ourselves, not only about how much novelty the world contains, but about men themselves, and how much greatness can be found among them. One of the oldest of man's visions was the flash of divinity in the great man. He seemed to appear for reasons men could not understand, and the secret of his greatness was God's secret. His generation thanked God for him as for the rain, for the Grand Canyon or the Matterhorn, or for being saved from the wreck at sea. Since the graphic revolution, however, much of our thinking about human greatness has changed. 2 centuries ago, when a great man appeared, people looked for God's purpose in him. Today, we look for his press agent. Shakespeare, in the familiar lines, divided great men into 3 classes: those born great, those who achieved greatness, and those who had greatness thrust upon them. It never occurred to him to mention those who hired public relations experts and press secretaries to make themselves look great. Now it is hard even to remember the time when the Hall of Fame was only a metaphor, whose inhabitants were selected by the inscrutable processes of history instead of by an ad hoc committee appointed to select the best-known names from the media. The root of our problem, the social source of these exaggerated expectations, is in our novel power to make men famous. Of course, there never was a time when fame was precisely the same thing as greatness, but until very recently, famous men and great men were pretty nearly the same group. "Fame," wrote Milton, "is the spur that clear spirit doth raise. Fame is no plant that grows on mortal soil." A man's name was not apt to become a household word unless he exemplified greatness in some way or other. He might be a Napoleon, great in power, a J.P. Morgan, great in wealth, a St. Francis, great in virtue, or a Bluebeard, great in evil. To become known to a whole people, a man usually had to be something of a hero. As the dictionary tells us, a man admired for his courage, nobility, or exploits. The war hero was the prototype, because the battle tested character and offered a stage for daring deeds. Before the graphic revolution, the slow, the natural way of becoming well-known was the usual way. Of course, there were a few men like the pharaohs and Augustus and the Shah Jahan who built monuments in their own day to advertise themselves to posterity, but a monument to command the admiration of a whole people was not quickly built. Thus, great men, like famous men, came into a nation's consciousness only slowly. The processes by which their fame was made were as mysterious as though by which God ruled the generations. The past became the natural habitat of great men. The universal lament of aging men in all epochs, then, is that greatness has become obsolete. So it has been commonly believed, in the words of Genesis, that there were giants in the earth in those days, in the days before the flood. Each successive age has believed that heroes, great men, dwelt mostly before its own time. Thomas Carlyle, in his classic Heroes, Hero Worship, and the Heroic in History, 1841, lamented that Napoleon was our last great man. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., at the age of 40, has noted with alarm in our day, 1958, that while great men seemed to dominate our lives and shape our destiny when he was young, today no one bestrides our narrow world like a colossus. We have no giants. This traditional belief in the decline of greatness has expressed the simple social fact that greatness has been equated with fame, and fame could not be made overnight. Within the last century, and especially since about 1900, we seem to have discovered the processes by which fame is manufactured. Now, at least in the United States, a man's name can become a household word overnight. The graphic revolution suddenly gave us, among other things, the means of fabricating well-knownness. Discovering that we, the television watchers, the moviegoers, radio listeners, and newspaper and magazine readers, and our servants, the television, movie, and radio producers, newspaper and magazine editors, and ad writers, can so quickly and effectively give a man fame, we have willingly been misled into believing that fame, well-knownness, is still a hallmark of greatness. Our power to fill our minds with more and more big names has increased our demand for big names and our willingness to confuse the big name with the big man. Again, mistaking our powers for our necessities, we have filled our world with artificial fame. Of course, we do not like to believe that our admiration is focused on a largely synthetic product. Having manufactured our celebrities, having willy-nilly made them our cynosures, the guiding stars of our interest, we are tempted to believe that they are not synthetic at all, that they are somehow still God-made heroes who now abound with a marvelous modern prodigality. The folklore of great men survives. We still believe, with Sidney Smith, who wrote in the early 19th century that great men hallow a whole people and lift up all who live in their time. We still agree with Carlyle that no sadder proof can be given by a man of his own littleness than disbelief in great men. Does not every true man feel that he himself is made higher by doing reverence to that which is really above him? We still are told from the pulpit, from Congress, from television screen and editorial page, that the lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime. Even in our 20th century age of doubt, when morality itself has been in ill repute, we have desperately held on to our belief in human greatness. For human models are more vivid and more persuasive than explicit moral commands. Cynics and intellectuals, too, are quicker to doubt moral theories than to question the greatness of their heroes. Agnostics and atheists may deny God, but they are slow to deny divinity to the great agnostics and atheists. While the folklore of hero worship, the zestful search for heroes, and the pleasure and reverence for heroes remain, the heroes themselves dissolve. The household names, the famous men who populate our consciousness, are, with few exceptions, not heroes at all, but an artificial new product, a product of the graphic revolution in response to our exaggerated expectations. The more readily we make them, and the more numerous they become, the less are they worthy of our admiration. We can fabricate fame. We can, at will, though usually at considerable expense, make a man or woman well-known, but we cannot make him great. We can make a celebrity, but we can never make a hero. In a now almost forgotten sense, all heroes are self-made. Celebrity worship and hero worship should not be confused, yet we confuse them every day, and by doing so we come dangerously close to depriving ourselves of all real models. We lose sight of the men and women who do not simply seem great because they are famous, but who are famous because they are great. We come closer and closer to degrading all fame into notoriety. In the last half century, the old heroic human mold has been broken. A new mold has been made. We have actually demanded that this mold be made so that marketable human models, modern heroes, could be mass-produced to satisfy the market and without any hitches. The qualities which now commonly make a man or woman into a nationally advertised brand are in fact a new category of human emptiness. Our new mold is shaped not of the stuff of our familiar morality, nor even of the old familiar reality. How has this happened? 1. The traditional heroic type includes figures as diverse as Moses, Ulysses, Aeneas, Jesus, Caesar, Mohammed, Joan of Arc, Shakespeare, Washington, Napoleon, and Lincoln. For our purposes, it is sufficient to define a hero as a human figure, real or imaginary or both, who has shown greatness in some achievement. He is a man or woman of great deeds. Of course, many such figures remain. But if we took a census of the names which populate the national consciousness, of all those who mysteriously dwell at the same time in the minds of all or nearly all Americans, we would now find the truly heroic figures in the old-fashioned mold to be a smaller proportion than ever before. There are many reasons for this. In the first place, of course, our democratic beliefs and our new scientific insights into human behavior have nibbled away at the heroes we have inherited from the past. Belief in the power of the common people to govern themselves, which has brought with it a passion for human equality, has carried a distrust, or at least a suspicion, of individual heroic greatness. A democratic people are understandably wary of finding too much virtue in their leaders, or of attributing too much of their success to their leaders. In the 20th century, the rise of Mussoliniism, Hitlerism, Stalinism, and of totalitarianism in general has dramatized the perils of any people's credulity in the power of the great leader. We have even come erroneously to believe that because tyranny in our time has flourished in the name of the Duce, the Führer, the omniscient all-virtuous Commissar, or the dictatorship of the proletariat, democracy must therefore survive without great leaders. Yet, long before Hitler or Stalin, the cult of the individual hero carried with it contempt for democracy. Hero worship, from Plato to Carlyle, was often a dogma of anti-democracy. Aristocracy, even in the mild and decadent form in which it survives in Great Britain today, is naturally more favorable to belief in heroes. If one is accustomed to a royal family, a queen, and a House of Lords, one is less apt to feel himself debased by bending the knee before any embodiment of human greatness. Most forms of government depend on a belief in the divine spark possessed by a favored few. But American democracy is embarrassed in the charismatic presence. We fear the man on horseback, the demigod, or the dictator. And if we have had fewer great men than have other peoples, it is perhaps because we have wanted, or would allow ourselves to have, fewer. Our most admired national heroes, Franklin, Washington, and Lincoln, are generally supposed to possess the common touch. We revere them not because they possess charisma, divine favor, a grace or talent granted them by God, but because they embody popular virtues. We admire them not because they reveal God, but because they reveal and elevate ourselves. While these democratic ideas have been arising, and while popular government has flourished in the United States, the growth of the social sciences has given us additional reasons to be sophisticated about the hero and to doubt his essential greatness. We now look on the hero as a common phenomenon of all societies. We learn, as Lord Raglan, a recent president of the Royal Anthropological Institute, pointed out in The Hero, 1936, that tradition is never historical. Having examined a number of well-known heroes of tradition, he concludes that there is no justification for believing that any of these heroes were real persons, or that any of the stories of their exploits had any historical foundation. These heroes, if they were genuinely heroes of tradition, were originally not men but gods. The stories were accounts not of fact but of ritual, that is, myths. Or we learn from Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, 1949, that all heroes, Oriental and Occidental, modern, ancient, and primitive, are the multiform expression of truths disguised for us under the figures of religion and mythology. Following Freud, Campbell explains all heroes as embodiments of a great monomyth. There are always the stages of 1. Separation or departure, 2. Trials and victories of initiation, and finally, 3. Return and reintegration with society. Nowadays, it matters little whether we see the hero exemplifying a universal falsehood or a universal truth. In either case, we now stand outside ourselves. We see greatness as an illusion, or if it does exist, we suspect we know its secret. We look with knowing disillusionment on our admiration for historical figures who used to embody greatness. Just as the Bible is now widely viewed in enlightened churches and synagogues as a composite document of outmoded folk beliefs, which can nevertheless be appreciated for its spiritual inspiration and literary value, so with the folk hero. He is no longer naively seen as our champion. We have become self-conscious about our admiration for all models of human greatness. We know that somehow they were not what they seem. They simply illustrate the laws of social illusion. The rise of scientific critical history and its handmade critical biography has had the same effect. In Japan, by contrast, the divine virtue of the emperors has been preserved by declaring them off-limits for the critical biographer. Even the Meiji Emperor, the enlightened emperor, founder of modern Japan, who kept detailed journals and left materials to delight a Western biographer, remains unportrayed in an accurate critical account. In the United States, until the 20th century, it was usual for biographies of public figures to be written by their admirers. These works were commonly literary memorials, tokens of friendship, of family devotion, or of political piety. This was true even of the better biographies. It was Henry Cabot Lodge Sr. who wrote the biography of Alexander Hamilton, Albert J. Beveridge, who wrote the life of John Marshall, Douglas Southall Freeman, who enshrined Robert E. Lee, and Carl Sandburg, who wrote a monument to Lincoln. This has ceased to be the rule, nor is this due only to the new schools of debunking biography, represented by Van Wyck Brooks' Mark Twain, 1920, and Henry James, 1925, W. E. Woodward's George Washington, 1926, and General Grant, 1928, which grew in the jaundiced 20s. The appearance of American history as a recognized learned specialty in the early 20th century has produced a new flood of biographical works which are only rarely inspired by personal admiration. Instead, they are often merely professional exercises. Scholars ply their tools and the chips fall where they may. We have thus learned a great deal more about our national heroes than earlier generations cared to know. Meanwhile, the influence of Karl Marx, the rise of economic determinism, a growing knowledge of economic and social history, and an increased emphasis on social forces have made the individual leader seem less crucial. The Pilgrim Fathers, we now are told, were simply representatives of the restless, upheaving middle classes. Their ideas expressed the rising Protestant ethic, which was the true prophet of modern capitalism. The Founding Fathers of the Constitution, Charles A. Beard and others have pointed out, were little more than spokesmen of certain property interests. Andrew Jackson became only one of many possible expressions of a rising West. The frontier itself became the hero, instead of the men. Isms, forces, and classes have spelled the death of the hero in our historical literature. Under the hot glare of psychology and sociology, the hero's heroic qualities have been dissolved into a blur of environmental influences and internal maladjustments. For example, Charles Sumner, 1811-1874, the aggressive abolitionist senator from Massachusetts, who was beaten over the head with a cane by Representative Preston S. Brooks of South Carolina, had long been a hero of the abolitionists, a martyr for the Northern cause. From the excellent scholarly biography by David Donald in 1960, Sumner emerges with barely a shred of nobility. He becomes a refugee from an unhappy youth. His ambition now seems to have stemmed from his early insecurity as the son of an illegitimate father, a half-outcast from Cambridge society. His principles in his later years, and his refusal to sit in the Senate for many months after his beating, no longer express a true crusader's passion. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once eulogized Sumner. "So when a great man dies for years beyond our ken, the light he leaves behind him lies upon the paths of men." But now, in David Donald's technical phrase, Sumner's conduct in his late years becomes a post-traumatic syndrome. In these middle decades of the 20th century, the hero has almost disappeared from our fiction as well. The central figure in any serious book is more likely to be a victim. In the plays of Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller, in the novels of Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, and John O'Hara, the leading roles are played by men who suffer from circumstances. Even the novelist's imagination is now staggered by the effort to conjure up human greatness. Today, every American, child or adult, encounters a vastly larger number of names, faces, and voices than at any earlier period or in any other country. Newspapers, magazines, second-class mail, books, radio, television, telephone, phonograph records. These and other vehicles confront us with thousands of names, people, or fragments of people. In our always more overpopulated consciousness, the hero every year becomes less significant. Not only does the newspaper or magazine reader, or television watcher, see the face and hear the voice of his president and the president's wife and family, he also sees the faces and hears the voices of his cabinet members, undersecretaries, senators, congressmen, and of their wives and children as well. Improvements in public education, with the always increasing emphasis on recent events, dilute the consciousness. The Titanic figure is now only one of thousands. This is ever more true as we secure a smaller proportion of our information from books. The hero, like the spontaneous event, gets lost in the congested traffic of pseudo-events. 2. The heroes of the past, then, are dissolved before our eyes or buried from our view. Except perhaps in wartime, we find it hard to produce new heroes to replace the old. We have made peculiar difficulties for ourselves by our fantastic rate of progress in science, technology, and the social sciences. The great deeds of our time are now accomplished on unintelligible frontiers. When heroism appeared, as it once did mostly on the battlefield or in personal combat, everybody could understand the heroic act. The claim of the martyr or the bluebeard to our admiration or horror was easy enough to grasp. When the dramatic accomplishment was an incandescent lamp, a steam engine, a telegraph, or an automobile, everybody could understand what the great man had accomplished. This is no longer true. The heroic thrusts now occur in the laboratory, among cyclotrons and betatrons, whose very names are popular symbols of scientific mystery. Even the most dramatic, best publicized adventures into space are on the edges of our comprehension. There are still, of course, rare exceptions, a Dr. Albert Schweitzer or a Dr. Tom Dooley, whose heroism is intelligible, but these only illustrate that intelligible heroism now occurs almost exclusively on the field of sainthood or martyrdom. There, no progress has been made for millennia. In the great areas of human progress, in science, technology, and the social sciences, our brave 20th century innovators work in the twilight, just beyond our understanding. This has obviously always been true to some extent. The work of profound thinkers has seldom been more than half intelligible to the lay public, but never so much as today. Despite the best efforts of ingenious and conscientious science reporters, now a profession all their own, our inventors and discoverers remain in the penumbra. With every decade, popular education falls farther behind technology. Sir Isaac Newton's Principia Mathematica was popularized for ladies and gentlemen who glimpsed the crude gist of his ideas. But how many popular lecturers, even so crudely, have explained Einstein's theory of relativity? Nowadays, our interest lies primarily in the mystery of the new findings. Fantastic possibilities engage our imagination without taxing our understanding. We acclaim the flights of Yuri Gagarin and Alan Shepard without quite grasping what they mean. Not only in science are the frontiers less intelligible. Perhaps most worshippers in Florence could grasp the beauty of a painting by a Cimabue or a Giotto. How many New Yorkers today can understand a Jackson Pollock or a Rothko? Our idolized writers are esoteric. How many can find their way in Joyce's Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake? Our most honored literati are only half intelligible to nearly all the educated community. How many understand a T.S. Eliot, a William Faulkner, a St. John Persay, a Quasimodo? Our great artists battle on a landscape we cannot chart, with weapons we do not comprehend, against adversaries we find unreal. How can we make them our heroes? As collaborative work increases in science, literature, and social sciences, we find it ever harder to isolate the individual hero for our admiration. The first nuclear chain reaction, which made the atom bomb and atomic power possible, was the product of a huge organization dispersed over the country. Who was the hero of the enterprise? Einstein, without whose theoretical boldness it would not have been conceivable? Or General Grove? Or Enrico Fermi? The social scientists' research enterprises have also become projects. An American Dilemma, the monumental study of the Negro and American democracy that was sponsored by the Carnegie Corporation, was the combined product of dozens of individual and collaborative studies. Gunnar Myrdal, director of the project and principal author of the book, played much the same role that the chairman of the board of directors does in a large corporation. The written works which reach the largest number of people in the United States today, advertisements and political speeches, are generally assumed to be collaborative work. The candidate making an eloquent campaign speech is admired for his administrative ingenuity in collecting a good team of speechwriters. We cannot read books by our public figures, even their autobiographies and most private memoirs, without being haunted by their ghostwriters. In the United States, we have, in a word, witnessed the decline of the folk and the rise of the mass. The usually illiterate folk, while unself-conscious, was creative in its own special ways. Its characteristic products were the spoken word, the gesture, the song, folklore, folk dance, folk song. The folk expressed itself. Its products are still gathered by scholars, antiquarians, and patriots. It was a voice. But the mass, in our world of mass media and mass circulation, is the target and not the arrow. It is the ear and not the voice. The mass is what others aim to reach by print, photograph, image, and sound. While the folk created heroes, the mass can only look and listen for them. It is waiting to be shown and to be told. Our society, to which the Soviet notion of the masses is so irrelevant, still is governed by our own idea of the mass. The folk had a universe of its own creation, its own world of giants and dwarfs, magicians and witches. The mass lives in the very different fantasy world of pseudo-events. The words and images which reach the mass disenchant big names in the very process of conjuring them up. 3. Our age has produced a new kind of eminence. This is as characteristic of our culture and our century as was the divinity of Greek gods in the 6th century BC, or the chivalry of knights and courtly lovers in the Middle Ages. It has not yet driven heroism, sainthood, or martyrdom completely out of our consciousness, but with every decade it overshadows them more. All older forms of greatness now survive only in the shadow of this new form. This new kind of eminence is celebrity. The word celebrity, from the Latin celebritas, for multitude or fame, and celeber, meaning frequented, populous, or famous, originally meant not a person, but a condition. As the Oxford English Dictionary says, the condition of being much talked about, famousness, notoriety. In this sense, it uses dates from at least the early 17th century. Even then, it had a weaker meaning than fame or renown. Matthew Arnold, for example, remarked in the 19th century that while the philosopher Spinoza's followers had celebrity, Spinoza himself had fame. For us, however, celebrity means primarily a person of celebrity. This usage of the word significantly dates from the early years of the graphic revolution, the first example being about 1850. Emerson spoke of the celebrities of wealth and fashion, 1848. Now, American dictionaries define celebrity as a famous or well-publicized person. The celebrity, in the distinctive modern sense, could not have existed in any earlier age or in America before the graphic revolution. The celebrity is a person who is known for his well-knownness. His qualities, or rather his lack of qualities, illustrate our peculiar problems. He is neither good nor bad, great nor petty. He is the human pseudo-event. He has been fabricated on purpose to satisfy our exaggerated expectations of human greatness. He is morally neutral, the product of no conspiracy, of no group promoting vice or emptiness. He is made by honest, industrious men of high professional ethics doing their job, informing and educating us. He is made by all of us who willingly read about him, who like to see him on television, who buy recordings of his voice and talk about him to our friends. His relation to morality and even to reality is highly ambiguous. He is like the woman in an Eleanor Glynn novel who describes another by saying, "She is like a figure in an Eleanor Glynn novel." The Massive Celebrity Register, 1959, compiled by Earl Blackwell and Cleveland Amory, now gives us a well-documented definition of the word, illustrated by over 2,200 biographies. We think we have a better yardstick than the Social Register or Who's Who or any such book, they explain. Our point is that it is impossible to be accurate in listing a man's social standing, even if anyone cared. And it's impossible to list accurately the success or value of men. But you can judge a man as a celebrity. All you have to do is weigh his press clippings. The Celebrity Register's alphabetical order shows Mortimer Adler followed by Polly Adler, the Dalai Lama listed beside TV comedian Dagmar, Dwight Eisenhower preceding Anita Ekberg, ex-President Hoover followed by ex-torch singer Libby Holman, Pope John XXIII coming after Mr. John, the hat designer, and Bertrand Russell followed by Jane Russell. They are all celebrities. The well-knownness which they have in common overshadows everything else. The advertising world has proved the market appeal of celebrities. In trade jargon, celebrities are big names. Endorsement advertising not only uses celebrities, it helps make them. Anything that makes a well-known name still better known automatically raises its status as a celebrity. The old practice, well established before the 19th century, of declaring the prestige of a product by the phrase, "by appointment to His Majesty," was, of course, a kind of use of the testimonial endorsement. But the king was in fact a great person, one of illustrious lineage and with impressive actual and symbolic powers. The king was not a venal endorser, and he was likely to use only superior products. He was not a mere celebrity, for the test of celebrity is nothing more than well-knownness. Studies of biographies in popular magazines suggest that editors, and supposedly also readers, of such magazines not long ago shifted their attention away from the old-fashioned hero. From the person known for some serious achievement, they have turned their biographical interests to the new-fashioned celebrity. Of the subjects of biographical articles appearing in the Saturday Evening Post and the now-defunct Collier's, in five sample years between 1901 and 1914, 74% came from politics, business, and the professions. But after about 1922, well over half of them came from the world of entertainment. Even among the entertainers, an ever-decreasing proportion has come from the serious arts, literature, fine arts, music, dance, and theater. An ever-increasing proportion, in recent years nearly all, come from the fields of light entertainment, sports, and the nightclub circuit. In the earlier period, say before World War I, the larger group included figures like the President of the United States, a senator, a state governor, the Secretary of the Treasury, the banker J.P. Morgan, the railroad magnate James J. Hill, a pioneer in aviation, the inventor of the torpedo, a Negro educator, an immigrant scientist, an opera singer, a famous poet, and a popular fiction writer. By the 1940s, the larger group included figures like the boxer Jack Johnson, Clark Gable, Bobby Jones, the movie actresses Brenda Joyce and Brenda Marshall, William Powell, the woman matador Conchita Cintron, the nightclub entertainer Adelaide Moffat, and the gorilla Toto. Some analysts say the shift is primarily the sign of a new focus of popular attention, away from production and toward consumption, but this is oversubtle. A simpler explanation is that the machinery of information has brought into being a new substitute for the hero, who is the celebrity, and whose main characteristic is his well-knownness. In the democracy of pseudo-events, anyone can become a celebrity if only he can get into the news and stay there. Figures from the world of entertainment and sports are most apt to be well known. If they are successful enough, they actually overshadow the real figures they portray. George Arliss overshadowed Disraeli. Vivian Leigh overshadowed Scarlett O'Hara. Fess Parker overshadowed Davy Crockett. Since their stock in trade is their well-knownness, they are most apt to have energetic press agents keeping them in the public eye. It is hardly surprising, then, that magazine and newspaper readers no longer find the lives of their heroes instructive. Popular biographies can offer very little in the way of solid information, for the subjects are themselves mere figments of the media. If their lives are empty of drama or achievement, it is only as we might have expected, for they are not known for drama or achievement. They are celebrities. Their chief claim to fame is their fame itself. They are notorious for their notoriety. If this is puzzling or fantastic, if it is mere tautology, it is no more puzzling or fantastic or tautologous than much of the rest of our experience. Our experience tends more and more to become tautology, needless repetition of the same in different words and images. Perhaps what ails us is not so much a vice as a nothingness. The vacuum of our experience is actually made emptier by our anxious straining with mechanical devices to fill it artificially. What is remarkable is not only that we manage to fill experience with so much emptiness, but that we manage to give the emptiness such appealing variety. We can hear ourselves straining, "He's the greatest." Our descriptions of celebrities overflow with superlatives. In popular magazine biographies, we learn that a Dr. Brinkley is the best-advertised doctor in the United States. An actor is the luckiest man in the movies today. A Ringling is not only the greatest, but the first real showman in the Ringling family. A general is one of the best mathematicians this side of Einstein. A columnist has one of the strangest of courtships. A statesman has the world's most exciting job. A sportsman is the loudest and by all odds the most abusive. A newsman is one of the most consistently resentful men in the country. A certain ex-king's mistress is one of the unhappiest women that ever lived. But despite the super colossal on the label, the contents are very ordinary. The lives of celebrities, which we like to read, as Leo Leventhal remarks, are a mere catalogue of hardships and breaks. These men and women are the proved specimens of the average. No longer external sources which fill us with purpose, these new model heroes are receptacles into which we pour our own purposelessness. They are nothing but ourselves seen in a magnifying mirror. Therefore, the lives of entertainer celebrities cannot extend our horizon. Celebrities populate our horizon with men and women we already know. Or, as an advertisement for the Celebrity Register cogently puts it, celebrities are the names who once made by news, now make news by themselves. Celebrity is made by simple familiarity, induced and reinforced by public means. The celebrity, therefore, is the perfect embodiment of tautology. The most familiar is the most familiar. 4. The hero was distinguished by his achievement, the celebrity by his image or trademark. The hero created himself. The celebrity is created by the media. The hero was a big man. The celebrity is a big name. Formerly, a public man needed a private secretary for a barrier between himself and the public. Nowadays, he has a press secretary to keep him properly in the public eye. Before the graphic revolution, and still in countries which have not undergone that revolution, it was a mark of solid distinction in a man or a family to keep out of the news. A lady of aristocratic pretensions was supposed to get her name in the papers only 3 times, when she was born, when she married, and when she died. Now, the families who are society are by definition those always appearing in the papers. The man of truly heroic stature was once supposed to be marked by scorn for publicity. He quietly relied on the power of his character or his achievement. In the South, where the media developed more slowly than elsewhere in the country, where cities appeared later, and where life was dominated by rural ways, the celebrity grew more slowly. The old-fashioned hero was romanticized. In this, as in many other ways, the Confederate General Robert E. Lee was one of the last surviving American models of the older type. Among his many admirable qualities, Southern compatriots admired none more than his retirement from public view. He had the reputation for never having given a newspaper interview. He steadfastly refused to write his memoirs. "I should be trading on the blood of my men," he said. General George C. Marshall, 1880 to 1959, is a more recent and more anachronistic example. He, too, shunned publicity and refused to write his memoirs, even while other generals were serializing theirs in the newspapers. But by his time, few people any longer considered this reticence a virtue. His old-fashioned unwillingness to enter the publicity arena finally left him a victim of the slanders of Senator Joseph McCarthy and others. The hero was born of time. His gestation required at least a generation. As the saying went, he had stood the test of time. A maker of tradition, he was himself made by tradition. He grew over the generations as people found new virtues in him and attributed to him new exploits. Receding into the misty past, he became more and not less heroic. It was not necessary that his face or figure have a sharp, well-delineated outline, nor that his life be footnoted. Of course, there could not have been any photographs of him, and often there was not even a likeness. Men of the last century were more heroic than those of today. Men of antiquity were still more heroic, and those of prehistory became demigods. The hero was always somehow ranked among the ancients. The celebrity, on the contrary, is always a contemporary. The hero is made by folklore, sacred texts, and history books. But the celebrity is the creature of gossip, of public opinion, of magazines, newspapers, and the ephemeral images of movie and television screen. The passage of time, which creates and establishes the hero, destroys the celebrity. One is made, the other unmade by repetition. The celebrity is born in the daily papers and never loses the mark of his fleeting origin. The very agency which first makes the celebrity, in the long run, inevitably destroys him. He will be destroyed as he was made, by publicity. The newspapers make him and they unmake him, not by murder, but by suffocation or starvation. No one is more forgotten than last generation celebrity. This fact explains the newspaper feature, "Whatever Became Of," which amuses us by accounts of the present obscurity of former celebrities. One can always get a laugh by referring knowingly to the once household names which have lost their celebrity in the last few decades: May Bush, William S. Hart, Clara Bow. A woman reveals her age by the celebrities she knows. There is not even any tragedy in the celebrity's fall, for he is a man returned to his proper anonymous station. The tragic hero, in Aristotle's familiar definition, was a man fallen from great estate, a great man with a tragic flaw. He had somehow become the victim of his own greatness. Yesterday's celebrity, however, is a commonplace man who has been fitted back into his proper commonplaceness, not by any fault of his own, but by time itself. The dead hero becomes immortal. He becomes more vital with the passage of time. The celebrity, even in his lifetime, becomes passé. He passes out of the picture. The white glare of publicity, which first gave him his specious brilliance, soon melts him away. This was so even when the only vehicles of publicity were the magazine and the newspaper. Still more now with our vivid round-the-clock media, with radio and television. Now, when it is possible, by bringing their voices and images daily into our living rooms, to make celebrities more quickly than ever before, they die more quickly than ever. This has been widely recognized by entertainment celebrities and politicians. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was careful to space out his fireside chats so the citizenry would not tire of him. Some comedians, for example, Jackie Gleason in the mid-1950s, have found that when they have weekly programs, they reap quick and remunerative notoriety, but that they soon wear out their images. To extend their celebrity lives, they offer their images more sparingly, once a month or once every 2 months instead of once a week. There is a subtler difference between the personality of the hero and that of the celebrity. The figures in each of the two classes become assimilated to one another, but in two rather different ways. Heroes, standing for greatness in the traditional mold, tend to become colorless and cliché. The greatest heroes have the least distinctiveness of face or figure. We may show our reverence for them, as we do for God, by giving them beards, yet we find it hard to imagine that Moses or Jesus could have had any special facial characteristics. The hero, while being thus idealized and generalized, loses his individuality. The fact that George Washington is not a vivid personality actually helps him serve as the heroic father of our country. Perhaps Emerson meant just this when he said finally that every great hero becomes a great bore. To be a great hero is actually to become lifeless, to become a face on a coin or a postage stamp. It is to become a Gilbert Stuart's Washington. Contemporaries, however, in the celebrities made of them, suffer from idiosyncrasy. They are too vivid, too individual to be polished into a symmetrical Greek statue. The graphic revolution, with its Klieg lights on face and figure, makes the images of different men more distinctive. This itself disqualifies them from becoming heroes or demigods. While heroes are assimilated to one another by the great simple virtues of their character, celebrities are differentiated mainly by trivia of personality. To be known for your personality actually proves you a celebrity. Thus, a synonym for a celebrity is a personality. Entertainers, then, are best qualified to become celebrities because they are skilled in the marginal differentiation of their personalities. They succeed by skillfully distinguishing themselves from others essentially like them. They do this by minutiae of grimace, gesture, language, and voice. We identify Jimmy Schnozzola Durante by his nose, Bob Hope by his fixed smile, Jack Benny by his stinginess, Jack Parr by his rudeness, Jackie Gleason by his waddle, Imogene Coca by her bangs. With the mushroom fertility of all pseudo-events, celebrities tend to breed more celebrities. They help make and celebrate and publicize one another. Being known primarily for their well-knownness, celebrities intensify their celebrity images simply by becoming widely known for relations among themselves. By a kind of symbiosis, celebrities live off one another. One becomes better known by being the habitual butt of another's jokes, by being another's paramour or ex-wife, by being the subject of another's gossip, or even by being ignored by another celebrity. Elizabeth Taylor's celebrity appeal has consisted less, perhaps, in her own talents as an actress than in her connections with other celebrities, Nick Hilton, Mike Todd, and Eddie Fisher. Arthur Miller, the playwright, became a real celebrity by his marriage to Marilyn Monroe. When we talk or read or write about celebrities, our emphasis on their marital relations and sexual habits, on their tastes in smoking, drinking, dress, sports cars, and interior decoration, is our desperate effort to distinguish among the indistinguishable. How can those commonplace people like us, who, by the grace of the media, happen to become celebrities, be made to seem more interesting or bolder than we are? 5. As other pseudo-events in our day tend to overshadow spontaneous events, so celebrities, who are human pseudo-events, tend to overshadow heroes. They are more up-to-date, more nationally advertised, and more apt to have press agents. And there are far more of them. Celebrities die quickly, but they are still more quickly replaced. Every year, we experience a larger number than the year before. Just as real events tend to be cast in the mold of pseudo-events, so in our society, heroes survive by acquiring the qualities of celebrities. The best publicized seems the most authentic experience. If someone does a heroic deed in our time, all the machinery of public information, press, pulpit, radio, and television, soon transform him into a celebrity. If they cannot succeed in this, the would-be hero disappears from public view. A dramatic, a tragic example, is the career of Charles A. Lindbergh. He performed single-handed one of the heroic deeds of this century. His deed was heroic in the best epic mold, but he became degraded into a celebrity. He then ceased to symbolize the virtues to which his heroic deed gave him a proper claim. He became filled with emptiness. Then he disappeared from view. How did this happen? On May 21, 1927, Charles A. Lindbergh made the first non-stop solo flight from Roosevelt Field, New York, to Le Bourget Airfield, Paris, in a monoplane, the Spirit of St. Louis. This was plainly a heroic deed in the classic sense. It was a deed of valor, alone against the elements. In a dreary, unheroic decade, Lindbergh's flight was a lightning flash of individual courage. Except for the fact of his flight, Lindbergh was a commonplace person. 25 years old at the time, he had been born in Detroit and raised in Minnesota. He was not a great inventor or leader of men. He was not extraordinarily intelligent, eloquent, or ingenious. Like many another young man in those years, he had a fanatical love of flying. The air was his element. There he showed superlative skill and extraordinary courage, even to foolhardiness. He was an authentic hero, yet this was not enough. Or perhaps it was too much. For he was destined to be made into a mere celebrity, and he was to be the American celebrity par excellence. His rise and fall as a hero, his tribulations, his transformation, and his rise and decline as a celebrity are beautifully told in Kenneth S. Davis's biography. Lindbergh himself had not failed to predict that his exploit would put him in the news. Before leaving New York, he had sold to the New York Times the exclusive story of his flight. A supposedly naive and diffident boy, on his arrival in Paris, he was confronted by a crowd of newspaper reporters at a press conference in Ambassador Myron T. Herrick's residence. But he would not give out any statement until he had clearance from the Times representative. He had actually subscribed to a newspaper clipping service. The clippings be sent to his mother, who was then teaching school in Minnesota. With uncanny foresight, however, he had limited his subscriptions to clippings to the value of $50. This did not prevent the company, doubtless seeking publicity as well as money, from suing him for not paying them for clippings beyond the specified amount. Otherwise, he might have had to spend the rest of his life earning the money to pay for clippings about himself. Lindbergh's newspaper success was unprecedented. The morning after his flight, the New York Times, a model of journalistic sobriety, gave him the whole of its first five pages, except for a few ads on page five. Other papers gave as much or more. Radio commentators talked of him by the hour, but there was not much hard news available. The flight was a relatively simple operation, lasting only 33.5 hours. Lindbergh had told reporters in Paris just about all there was to tell. During his 25 years, he had led a relatively uneventful life. He had few quirks of face, of figure, or of personality. Little was known about his character. Some young women called him tall and handsome, but his physical averageness was striking. He was the boy next door. To tell about this young man on the day after his flight, the nation's newspapers used 25,000 tons of newsprint more than usual. In many places, sales were 2 to 5 times normal, and might have been higher if the presses could have turned out more papers. When Lindbergh returned to New York on June 13, 1927, the New York Times gave its first 16 pages the next morning almost exclusively to news about him. At the testimonial dinner in Lindbergh's honor at the Hotel Commodore, reputed to be the largest for an individual in modern history, Charles Evans Hughes, former Secretary of State and about to become Chief Justice of the United States, delivered an extravagant eulogy. With unwitting precision, he characterized the American hero-turned-celebrity. "We measure heroes as we do ships, by their displacement. Colonel Lindbergh has displaced everything." Lindbergh was, by now, the biggest human pseudo-event of modern times. His achievement, actually because it had been accomplished so neatly and with such spectacular simplicity, offered little spontaneous news. The biggest news about Lindbergh was that he was such big news. Pseudo-events multiplied in more than the usual geometric progression, for Lindbergh's well-knownness was so sudden and so overwhelming. It was easy to make stories about what a big celebrity he was, how this youth, unknown a few days before, was now a household word, how he was received by presidents and kings and bishops. There was little else one could say about him. Lindbergh's singularly impressive heroic deed was soon far overshadowed by his even more impressive publicity. If well-knownness made a celebrity, here was the greatest. Of course, it was remarkable to fly the ocean by oneself, but far more remarkable thus to dominate the news. His stature as hero was nothing compared with his stature as celebrity. All the more because it had happened literally overnight. A large proportion of the news soon consisted of stories of how Lindbergh reacted to the news and to the publicity about himself. People focused their admiration on how admirably Lindbergh responded to publicity, how gracefully he accepted his role of celebrity. Quickie biographies appeared. These were little more than digests of newspaper accounts of the publicity jags during Lindbergh's ceremonial visits to the capitals of Europe and the United States. This was the celebrity afterlife of the heroic Lindbergh. This was the tautology of celebrity. During the next few years, Lindbergh stayed in the public eye and remained a celebrity primarily because of two events. One was his marriage on May 27, 1929, to the cultivated and pretty Anne Morrow, daughter of Dwight Morrow, a Morgan partner, then ambassador to Mexico. Now it was the lone eagle and his mate. As a newlywed, he was more than ever attractive raw material for news. The maudlin pseudo-events of romance were added to all the rest. His newsworthiness was revived. There was no escape. Undaunted newsmen, thwarted in efforts to secure interviews and lacking solid facts, now made columns of copy from Lindbergh's efforts to keep out of the news. Some newspaper men, lacking other material for speculation, cynically suggested that Lindbergh's attempts to dodge reporters were motivated by a devious plan to increase his news interest. When Lindbergh said he would cooperate with sober, respectable papers, but not with others, those left out pyramided his rebuffs into more news than his own statements would have made. The second event which kept Lindbergh alive as a celebrity was the kidnapping of his infant son. This occurred at his new country house in Hopewell, New Jersey, on the night of March 1, 1932. For almost 5 years, Lindbergh had been an empty receptacle into which newsmakers had poured their concoctions, saccharin, maudlin, legendary, slanderous, adulatory, or only fantastic. Now, when all other newsmaking possibilities seemed exhausted, his family was physically consumed. There was a good story in it. Here was blood sacrifice, as Kenneth S. Davis calls it, to the gods of publicity. Since the case was never fully solved, despite the execution of the supposed kidnapper, no one can know whether the child would have been returned unharmed if the press and the public had behaved differently. But the press, with the collaboration of the bungling police, who had unwittingly destroyed real clues, then garnered and publicized innumerable false clues, and did nothing solid to help. They exploited Lindbergh's personal catastrophe with more than their usual energy. In its way, the kidnapping of Lindbergh's son was as spectacular as Lindbergh's transatlantic flight. In neither case was there much hard news, but this did not prevent the filling of newspaper columns. City editors now gave orders for no space limit on the kidnapping story. "I can't think of any story that would compare with it," observed the general news manager of the United Press, "unless America should enter a war." Hearst's INS photo service assigned its whole staff. They chartered two ambulances which, with sirens screaming, shuttled between Hopewell and New York City, carrying photographic equipment out to the Lindbergh estate, and on the way back to the city, served as mobile darkrooms in which pictures were developed and printed for delivery on arrival. For on-the-spot reporting at Hopewell, INS had an additional 5 men with 3 automobiles. United Press had 6 men and 3 cars. The Associated Press had 4 men, 2 women, and 4 cars. By midnight of March 1st, the New York Daily News had 9 reporters at Hopewell, and 3 more arrived the next day. The New York American had 12, including William Randolph Hearst, Jr., the paper's president. The New York Herald Tribune, 4, the New York World Telegram, the New York Times, and the Philadelphia Ledger, each about 10. This was only a beginning. The next day, the press agreed to Lindbergh's request to stay off the Hopewell grounds in order to encourage the kidnapper to return the child. The torrent of news did not stop. Within 24 hours, INS sent over its wires 50,000 words, enough to fill a small volume, about the crime, 30,000 words the following day, and for some time thereafter, 10,000 or more words a day. The Associated Press and United Press served their subscribers just as well. Many papers gave the story the whole of the front page, plus inside carryovers for a full week. There were virtually no new facts available. Still, the news poured forth. Pseudo-events by the score. Clues, rumors, local color features, and what the trade calls think pieces. Soon, there was almost nothing more to be done journalistically with the crime itself. There was little more to be reported, invented, or conjectured. Interest then focused on a number of sub-dramas created largely by newsmen themselves. These were stories about how the original event was being reported, about the mix-up among the different police that had entered the case, and about who would or should be Lindbergh's spokesman to the press world and his go-between with the kidnapper. Much news interest still centered on what a big story all the news added up to, and on how Mr. and Mrs. Lindbergh reacted to the publicity. At this point, the Prohibition-era crime celebrities came into the picture. Salvi Spatali and Irving Bitz, New York speakeasy owners, briefly held the spotlight. They had been suggested by Morris Rosner, who, because he had underworld connections, soon became a kind of personal secretary to the Lindberghs. Spatali and Bitz earned headlines for their effort to make contact with the kidnappers, then suspected to be either the notorious Purple Gang of Detroit or Al Capone's mob in Chicago. The two go-betweens became big names until Spatali bowed out, appropriately enough, at a press conference. There he explained, "If it was someone I knew, I'll be goddamned if I would name him. I've been in touch all around, and I come to the conclusion that this one was pulled by an independent." Al Capone himself, more a celebrity than ever, since he was about to begin a federal prison term for income tax evasion, increased his own newsworthiness by trying to lend a hand. In an interview with the serious columnist Arthur Brisbane of the Hearst Papers, Capone offered $10,000 for information leading to the recovery of the child unharmed and to the capture of the kidnappers. It was even hinted that to free Capone might help recover the child. The case itself produced a spate of new celebrities, whose significance no one quite understood, but whose newsworthiness itself made them important. These included Colonel H. Norman Schwarzkopf, commander of the New Jersey State Police; Harry Wolfe, chief of police in Hopewell; Betty Gow, the baby's nurse; Colonel Breckinridge, Lindbergh's personal counsel; Dr. J.F. Jaffe Condon, a retired Bronx schoolteacher who was a volunteer go-between. He offered to add to the ransom money his own $1,000 life savings, so a loving mother may again have her child, and Colonel Lindbergh may know that the American people are grateful for the honor bestowed on them by his pluck and daring. John Hughes Curtis, a half-demented Norfolk, Virginia boatbuilder who pretended to reach the kidnappers. Gaston B. Means, author of The Strange Death of President Harding, later convicted of swindling Mrs. Evelyn Walsh McLean out of $104,000 by posing as a negotiator with the kidnappers. Violet Sharp, a waitress in the Morrow home, who married the Morrow butler and who had a date with a young man, not her husband, on the night of the kidnapping. She committed suicide on threat of being questioned by the police. And countless others. Only a few years later, the spotlight was turned off Lindbergh as suddenly as it had been turned on him. The New York Times Index, a thick volume published yearly, which lists all references to a given subject in the pages of the newspaper during the previous 12 months, records this fact with statistical precision. Each volume of the index for the years 1927 to 1940 contains several columns of fine print merely itemizing the different news stories which referred to Lindbergh. The 1941 volume shows over three columns of such listings. Then, suddenly, the news stream dries up, first to a mere trickle, then to nothing at all. The total listings for all 17 years, from 1942 through 1958, amount to less than two columns. Only about half that found in the single year, 1941. In 1951 and 1958, there was not even a single mention of Lindbergh. In 1957, when the movie The Spirit of St. Louis, starring James Stewart, was released, it did poorly at the box office. A poll of the preview audiences showed that few viewers under 40 years of age knew about Lindbergh. A New Yorker cartoon gave the gist of the matter. A father and his young son are leaving a movie house where they have just seen The Spirit of St. Louis. "If everyone thought what he did was so marvelous," the boy asks his father, "how come he never got famous?" The hero thus died a celebrity's sudden death. In his 14 years, he had already long outlasted the celebrity's usual lifespan. An incidental explanation of this quick demise of Charles A. Lindbergh was his response to the pressure to be all around. Democratic faith was not satisfied that its hero be only a dauntless flyer. He had to become a scientist, an outspoken citizen, and a leader of men. His celebrity status, unfortunately, had persuaded him to become a public spokesman. When Lindbergh gave in to these temptations, he offended. But his offenses, unlike those, for example, of Al Capone and his henchmen, who used to be applauded when they took their seats in a ballpark, were not in themselves dramatic or newsworthy enough to create a new notoriety. His pronouncements were dull, petulant, and vicious. He acquired a reputation as a pro-Nazi and a crude racist. He accepted a decoration from Hitler. Very soon, the celebrity was being uncelebrated. The Lindbergh Beacon, atop a Chicago skyscraper, was renamed the Palmolive Beacon. And high in the Colorado Rockies, Lindbergh Peak was rechristened the noncommittal Lone Eagle Peak. 6. Since the graphic revolution, the celebrity overshadows the hero by the same relentless law which gives other kinds of pseudo-events an overshadowing power. When a man appears as hero and or celebrity, his role as celebrity obscures and is apt to destroy his role as hero. The reasons, too, are those which tend to make all pseudo-events predominate. In the creation of a celebrity, somebody always has an interest. Newsmen needing stories, press agents paid to make celebrities, and the celebrity himself. But dead heroes have no such interest in their publicity, nor can they hire agents to keep them in the public eye. Celebrities, because they are made to order, can be made to please, comfort, fascinate, and flatter us. They can be produced and displaced in rapid succession. The people once felt themselves made by their heroes. The idol, said James Russell Lowell, is the measure of the worshiper. Celebrities are made by the people. The hero stood for outside standards. The celebrity is a tautology. We still try to make our celebrities stand in for the heroes we no longer have, or for those who have been pushed out of our view. We forget that celebrities are known primarily for their well-knownness, and we imitate them as if they were cast in the mold of greatness. yet the celebrity is usually nothing greater than a more publicized version of us. In imitating him, in trying to dress like him, talk like him, look like him, think like him, we are simply imitating ourselves. In the words of the psalmist, "They that make them are like unto them, so is every one that trusteth in them." By imitating a tautology, we ourselves become a tautology, standing for what we stand for, reaching to become more emphatically what we already are. When we praise our famous men, we pretend to look out the window of history. We do not like to confess that we are looking into a mirror. We look for models, and we see our own image. Inevitably, most of our few remaining heroes hold our attention by being recast in the celebrity mold. We try to become chummy, gossipy, and friendly with our heroes. In the process, we make them affable and flattering to us. Jesus, we are told from the pulpit, was no sissy, but a regular fellow. Andrew Jackson was a great guy. Instead of inventing heroic exploits for our heroes, we invent commonplaces about them. For example, in the successful juvenile series, The Childhood of Famous Americans. It is commonplaces and not exploits which make them celebrities. Our very efforts to debunk celebrities, to prove, whether by critical journalistic biographies or by vulgar confidential magazines, that they are unworthy of our admiration, are like efforts to get behind the scenes in the making of other pseudo-events. They are self-defeating. They increase our interest in the fabrication. As much publicity yardage can be created one way as another. Of course, most true celebrities have press agents, and these press agents sometimes themselves become celebrities. The hat, the rabbit, and the magician are all equally news. It is twice as newsworthy that a charlatan can become a success. His charlatanry makes him even more of a personality. A celebrity's private newsmaking apparatus, far from disillusioning us, simply proves him authentic and fully equipped. We are reassured then that we are not mistaking a nobody for a somebody. It is not surprising that the word hero has itself become a slang term of cynical reproach. Critics of the American Legion call it the Heroes Union. What better way of deflating or irritating a self-important person than by calling him our hero? The very word belongs, we think, in the world of preliterate societies, of comic strip Supermen, or of William Stieg's Small Fry. In America today, heroes, like fairy tales, are seldom for sophisticated adults. But we multiply our Oscars and Emmys, our awards for Father of the Year, our crowns for Mrs. America and Miss Photo Flash. We have our Hall of Fame for Great Americans, our Agricultural Hall of Fame, our Baseball Hall of Fame, our Rose Bowl Hall of Fame. We strain to reassure ourselves that we admire the admirable and honor the meritorious. But in the very act of straining, we confuse and distract ourselves. At first reluctantly, then with fascination. We observe the politicking behind every prize and the shenanigans in front of every effort to enshrine a celebrity or to enthrone a queen for a day. Despite our best intentions, our contrivance to provide substitute heroes finally produces nothing but celebrities. To publicize is to expose. With our unprecedented power to magnify the images and popularize the virtues of heroes, our machinery only multiplies and enlarges the shadows of ourselves. Somehow, we cannot make ourselves so uncritical that we reverence or respect, however much we may be interested in, the reflected images of our own emptiness. We continue surreptitiously to wonder whether greatness is not a naturally scarce commodity, whether it can ever really be synthesized. Perhaps, then, our ancestors were right in connecting the very idea of human greatness with a belief in a God. Perhaps man cannot make himself. Perhaps heroes are born and not made. Among the ironic frustrations of our age, none is more tantalizing than these efforts of ours to satisfy our extravagant expectations of human greatness. Vainly do we make scores of artificial celebrities grow where nature planted only a single hero. As soon as a hero begins to be sung about today, he evaporates into a celebrity. No man can be a hero to his valet, or, Carlyle might have added, to his Time reporter. In our world of big names, curiously, our true heroes tend to be anonymous. In this life of illusion and quasi-illusion, the person with solid virtues who can be admired for something more substantial than his well-knownness often proves to be the unsung hero. The teacher, the nurse, the mother, the honest cop, the hard worker at lonely, underpaid, unglamorous, unpublicized jobs. Topsy-turvily, these can remain heroes precisely because they remain unsung. Their virtues are not the product of our effort to fill our void. Their very anonymity protects them from the flashy, ephemeral celebrity life. They alone have the mysterious power to deny our mania for more greatness than there is in the world.